This is the Israel Connection on JA Community Radio, broadcasting on 88 FM and streaming over the internet at j-air.com.au. My name is David Schulberg, bringing you another episode of this weekly radio program that provides analysis and insight with important interviews and discussion about Israel. Born in Tel Aviv and educated at UCLA and Columbia College in Chicago, Duki Dror is an internationally award-winning documentary filmmaker. His extensive body of work has won him international recognition and success. His latest production is about the Nova Music Festival massacre. Duki Dror, who is an independent Israeli filmmaker whose films explore issues of migration, identity, and displacement. Welcome to the Israel Connection, Duki.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We're talking about your film, which is about the Nova Music Festival massacre, ostensibly. So why have you initiated a campaign to get Netflix to host your documentary? Why do you see that as being important?
Well, you know, it's not that I was able to get Netflix to make this documentary. It's a little difficult these days to have documentaries on this subject or in the Israeli-Palestinian subject on a platform like Netflix, which is very hesitant on having controversial or political documentaries, and they just want people to sit down and enjoy some music documentaries and stuff like that. I initiated this film actually the next day after October 7th, on October 8th. It was a Sunday, and after the shock and horror that we were facing on that Black Saturday, I realized that we are facing something not only in the battlefield, not only that Hamas was terrorizing Israel in such a vicious way, but also we were terrorized by the media. And on Saturday already, I was checking social media, and I saw this campaign going on against Israel from the river to the sea, and denial of what's going on, the massacre. And I realized this is something that has to be done. I have to do something to document this horrific event, to bring it out as soon as possible to an audience around the world. So I called my partner in Germany, and I told them, okay, we have to do this. This is a big story. It is a big story as a media story, but also it's really important to bring it out as soon as this massacre happened. So first of all, to get the first reaction of people who survived this massacre, and to be, in a way, to be as close to the crime scene as possible and bring out these testimonials from the survivors. And then to get it out to the people, to the world audience, so people will understand what happened there. In face of the denial, in face of this media war that was launched against the truth, basically, and human values.
So you're probably skeptical from what you're saying about it seeing the light of day on Netflix, although you may be aware of another film which was not pro-Israel, a film called Faha, that has been shown on Netflix, and there was a lot of opposition to that because that's a Jordanian film which depicts the way that Israel operated going back to the Nakba in ways that Israelis would in many ways deny. So it would seem like quid pro quo that it would be fair to give this side of the story when they've already done something on the other side.
I don't know. I'm not going to judge this, because usually if this was aired now, it took 2 years to, at least 2 years to license this program that was on Netflix. And Things are really changing rapidly in Netflix. So I'm not sure this is just like only to get on one side of the picture.
Yes.
That was it was a Netflix's way of choosing one side. So I'm not sure.
So, have you, what sort of distribution channels have you then been following to get the film into the public eye?
Well, the film is an international co-production, so there's a France, Germany, and Israel have co-produced this film, and we have international distribution for of the film. It was already acquired in 40 different countries and has been in tens of film festivals around the world. And a lot of community screenings, especially in the United States, in Jewish communities, which are very vulnerable now. And I was in the US about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, and I felt that the how vulnerable the Jewish community in the United States is in need to see this, because this is depicting what, you know, the narrative. It's of course it's the Israeli narrative, but it's the narrative of reality, of truth in face of really a very dishonest and fake depiction of what happened, and in the face of the assault on Israeli Jewish point of view narrative by in social media mostly, but also in the academic world, which is this is the very scary thing. And we had a few screenings also in universities in the United States, in Yale and in UPenn, which are were part of this academic assault. And it was, I think, if you, I think from my perspective and my feeling from these screenings, is that if you really say the truth and w show what happened, it's very, very honest what we have seen. Very honest these testimonials from the people who were there at the Nova Festival, and you keep on saying the truth with not cave in to this. You see it everywhere, trying to put you down. There's only one narrative, and this is the Palestinian narrative. And if you insist on saying the truth, things will work. Things will people will understand eventually that this is something to understand, to look, and to realize that what happened is unacceptable in any human moral value that can be seen. And this is the main issue here, not anything else that are trying to do to divert our sight to.
Well, the trouble is that, as they say, truth is the first victim of war. That's unfortunately the way it goes. Have there been protests at the screenings you've been having of the film in the US, especially at academic institutions?
Well, I was expecting that, and actually I was expecting it in a way, okay, let's have it and see this and confront it, but there was nothing there. I think one of the reasons is that there's a propaganda war against us. When you show something so sincere, so vivid, it's a war I think the other side will, you know, try to avoid. So there was no confrontation, real confrontation in these screenings. Who knows? We still have a lot of more screenings. We had many screenings in other places in Europe, and they were all really very powerful, very strong. Of course, this is the story of these Israeli kids who went to the music festival. This is what happened to them. I think, though, from my point of view at least, I saw it as an assault on free society, not Israeli society, but the free society that were attacked so viciously by 7th century.
Barbarians.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's the first impression I get when I'm watching the film, seeing people, young people enjoying themselves as we do in the West, in a way that would be viewed by the people that came over from Gaza as being a very decadent form of behavior. And it would have been a place for them really to target, because that's what they revile in their belief system.
That's true. I think that's the main thing. The main theme for us as the people who made this film, me and my partners, it was to really focus on that, not focus on the Israeli-Palestinian issue or story, but rather to show how fragile is our society, our free society in the West. From this, I mean, we don't really understand how fragile our society, free society, is. And they're speaking about freedom fighters, but these are fighters against freedom. This is what scares them the most, as you said. The freedom is the major danger for these Hamas Iranian regimes. So they have to fight that. So you call it Israeli, you call it Australian, you call it West. This is the danger, and they have to fight it.
So I posted up on my Facebook page the ad for the campaign to get the film on Netflix. I got one comment which I thought I'd share with you, Dookie. The comment was from a person who said, "This is totally misguided and disrespectful, and that is an understatement." So I followed up by asking, "Why do you say this?" I asked, "Isn't it important to show as many people as possible, especially the skeptics, what actually happened on October the 7th?" And I got this reply: "Would you like to see your sister or daughter being gang raped and slaughtered so publicly? Surely the family and friends have enough trauma knowing that it happened. Showing it as proof to journalists was maybe necessary. Showing it to the public is feeding perversion." I think this remark is a bit extreme, and I don't agree with it. But what have you had any of this kind of reaction, that people have said that this is not the thing to do, to show this kind of thing publicly?
I think we tried to be very gentle with what we were showing in the film. I mean, we didn't show any depictions that are too horrific. Of course, this is pretty horrific story, but we didn't try. We tried not to make it a horror show, and because we wanted to. First, we wanted to respect the people who were talking, and we mostly used our protagonists' documented videos. I mean, they're self-documenting themselves, and of course, we had to put more videos that Hamas were taking and showing how really vicious it is, but we didn't really get into the hardcore of stuff. And actually, the reaction that we got was more of, why didn't you show more details? Why you were so sinister? There were so much more graphic stuff going on, and you tried to mellow it down. And I say that I want to have as much audience as possible to see this, because this is something that happened, and in order that this will not happen again, as actually Hamas leader were saying after the October 7th attack, they said it's going to be another 7th October, another one, and another one, in order to warn against it. This has to be shown, this has to be documented and shown to the public. even though it's really a hard documentary to
Yes.
watch. It's not
Yeah, it's
easy.
very hard to watch, I have to say. But it brings to mind this 48-minute official video that has been produced about the October 7th massacre overall, which has been used by Israel to show the world the real true horror of what happened. And that has a graphic depiction in it, which is very hard to watch. Have you seen it yourself?
I saw parts of it. I was too much exposed to really graphic material, and it was not easy for me also emotionally to go through all these videos during the editing of the film. So it was I try to if I don't have to watch stuff, I will not. So.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen it myself either, and I have no need to now because I'm totally convinced and with all that I've heard and seen. But this goes back to that comment I made by that person that I alluded to earlier. It's her comment would perhaps be pertinent if it was relating to this documentary that was produced officially, and as we know, Israel has only shown it to limited audiences.
Right,
And
right.
I've seen comments that Israel should have shown it more widely to more people. Do you think that Israel has found the right way to approach the use of this particular video, or they should have put it out there for more people to see to have more impact? Or has Israel been too soft and is not pushing hard enough what actually happened so that it's right out in front of people? You have an opinion on that?
I think that if you're talking about the Israeli officials, government, I don't think they do enough to show or to explain. It's more like to explain what happened on October 7th. But I think that we are the Israeli civil society finds itself very strong, and I'm sure that you'll see a lot of stories coming out from October 7th in the next years or more, explaining what happened, bringing this story out to the world. And this is by private people who really were facing this horror and facing this historic moment that tantalized them, like myself. And Israel officially, I don't think they handle this very well. I think, but they have so many other fields to fight in, specifically regarding this film. I don't think that this should be shown widely. I think that it needs to be shown only to specific people who can report on that.
Yeah, we have a foreign minister that came to visit Israel. She spoke to a few of the people who are connected with the hostages and so forth, but she didn't go down to the south to see with her own eyes. I think that was a very serious mistake. I would have hoped in her case that this film has been put in front of her, at least that she would have seen the film, if not the reality. In the horrible detail that was there. You produced your film in a very short time, didn't you? Most of the footage, I suppose, was readily available from what actually happened on the day. How long did it take to get it all together and released? I suppose that's probably the fastest you've ever produced a film, I would have thought.
Yes, absolutely. It's completely different from documentaries I'm making. Usually it takes 2 years, 3 years.
Yes.
You have to sink in into the subject and to have the perspective on that. This was really it was a call for action for me, and I had to produce it really fast. We did it first. We did a half an hour for German and French TV. And it was aired end of November, so it took less than 2 months, a month and a half. Actually, we had a lot of conversations with the broadcaster in France. There were quite hesitant on showing it in the beginning, and they eventually we had to get through some barriers, I think political barriers that they went that to get it out first there in France. And then it took another 2 months to finish the 1 hour documentary. I'm happy to say that it was really quite amazingly was distributed in most of European countries on April 7th, the 6 months to the October 7th massacre. It's going to air on BBC, BBC World, and in numerous countries around the world, South America and some Asian countries. I'm not sure if Australia was already in purchased the film, but I hope it's on its way to Australia too.
Yes, you're just begging my question there. When you say you're not sure, how does it get to be shown in Australia? Who would be looking to bring it here?
Well, we have a international distribution for the film. ABC could be a good place to air the film, and other
Well,
SBS.
I mean, it's suitable to be shown as a TV documentary. That's what it really.
Yes, I think this is the most of the public television stations in Europe has been licensed it. Have been licensed it, and also some of the commercial TV broadcasters like Canal Plus in France, and the streamers in South America, and have been licensing it. So
Yes.
it is a very important documentary, even though it's very hard. The story is really. It's not an easy documentary to watch. It's not like you can sync with that or have fun with this. I think it is also a story of victory. These people, these seven protagonists that we interviewed, they all survived. They all survived a vicious attack. They are there just a few days after the massacre. They were there to tell their story, to bring it out, to bring a vivid picture of what happened. And I think this is, in a way, of although the tragic story that we were showing, this was something that you can look at and say, okay, there is a victory there. They were strong enough to tell the story just a few days after it happened. And they're doing this amazingly. I mean, they were sitting there, even though they went through this horror, they were very honest, very direct in what they were telling us.
Now, I want to just allude to what you did previously in your long career as a filmmaker. And I think people need to be aware that you were a very well-established maker of a film, and you made a significant documentary series about Israel's most turbulent generation, beginning in 1995 with the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and the pivotal events that followed that. This was shown on Kan, Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation, not in Australia. It was aired on Israel's 75th anniversary. Unfortunately, a lot of this material, I suppose, will be picked up by Israeli companies that are showing cinema through various media outlets. But get it on mainstream TV is difficult. But did you see this as a significant creation of yours, and what do you think it reflects about the state of Israeli society today? Of course, Israeli society today is united because of the war, but after the war goes, I suppose what you've said in this film, this documentary series, we're going to see evidence of it again.
Yeah, I think Israeli society is very dynamic, and it's a young country. You know, we have to realize that 75 years is a young country, and it's going through crises and challenges. Generation turmoil, or the battle of the tribes, the docu-series that you referred to. Actually, it was also has been shown in Germany and France. Again, they are my partners all the time on films that I'm making. I think that for me this was a major work, because these are very turbulent years through the last three decades that we passed from the Oslo Accords until 2022 and the election, where Netanyahu won again and tried to go into war with the
The Supreme Court.
Supreme Court.
Yes.
And that was a turbulent moment. But I think it was a turbulent moment that was the tip of 30 years from Oslo Accord, when things split. Israeli society split between left and right, and between seculars and religious. And this fault line just opened wider and wider until that moment, which was a year ago. I think what I try to do in this docu-series is really to put things in order, to understand the narratives of each side of the Israeli tribes, as we call them, and understand how each sector or tribe is viewing these 3 decades that have passed. And that was very interesting. I mean, this was for me, it was a travel into back 30 years and understanding the same story that I perceived as a liberal, secular, leftist person through other points of view, of the ultra-Orthodox, or the right wing, or the settlers, or the Arabs. So you have like a whole spectrum of understanding how the society evolved in the last 3 decades. That was fascinating, and I thought that this is something and it was actually was accepted by the public in Israel like that. This is okay. There's something that we can see, and it makes order in our head. We understand better now what happened here, because our things are going so rapidly, fast here. It's very fast. Things are changing. We forget what happened last year. Right now, we almost forgot what happened last year with the Supreme Court, overrunning the Supreme Court, because there's a major war now. I think that's part of my work as a documentary filmmaker, to look at history and put it in order, and people to get people to understand. And I think maybe this is the most important thing for documentary filmmaker to do, is to put things in order, to get people to understand what happened.
Thank you for speaking with me today on my program, and for the great important job you're doing in bringing all these things to the fore with our society. And I do hope that we'll see your film on the massacre in Australia. I certainly will send out some messages to the powers that be to make efforts to get your film shown on Australian television.
Amazing. Thank you very much, David.
Whatever, I think it's important. I have been speaking with Dooki Dror, the director of the film Supernova, the Music Festival Massacre. My next guest is Nachum Kaplan, an ex-Aussie who has started up a site titled Moral Clarity, Truth in Politics and Culture, in an effort to counter the misinformation and disinformation being delivered to us by the mischievous purveyors of propaganda. I'd like to welcome Nachum Kaplan to the Israel Connection. Nachum holds a degree in politics from Monash University in his native Australia and has spent 30 years working as a journalist, commentator, and C-suite media strategist to Fortune 500 companies. For those listeners who are not aware what a C-suite media strategist is, it's basically somebody who appeals to the high-powered bosses of such companies in particular. He's held senior editorial positions and helped set the strategic direction in some of the world's leading newsrooms, including Reuters and International Financing Review. Nachum has worked in Australia, Indonesia, the UK, Singapore, and travelled extensively for his work. Good morning to you, Nachum, from Singapore.
Good morning, David. Thank you for having me on.
We know that understanding the world is harder than ever. There is too much information, too much propaganda, and too much virtue signalling. This is what you say on your website, Moral Clarity, Truths in Politics and Culture, which is your vehicle to speak truth to nonsense. Can you tell us a bit about your endeavour that invites readers to get an experienced, professional and critical take on key global developments related to politics, culture and media?
Well, Moral Clarity was really born from October the 7th. I've kind of been kicking the idea around of doing something along this for a little while. And then when October 7 happened, which was, obviously I was as shocked as everybody else was by the events that day, but what shocked me even more was the response to it. Even before Israel had regained control of its territory, even before Israel had fired a retaliatory shot, there were protests in streets from London, from Sydney, Toronto, New York, Paris, Kuala Lumpur, you name it, they were out there and they were just chanting wildly, rabidly anti-Semitic bile, quite frankly. Nothing was done to stop these people. We literally had the surreal situation in which we were watching the police keeping the streets safe for the jihadists and the Nazis. So that really bothered me. And then what bothered me even more was to see the media pick up on that same narrative. Even before there was an actual body count on how many people Hamas had killed, even before that, there was pleas for it to be seen in context for what had happened. Nothing happens in isolation in the Middle East. It has to be seen in context. And all this kind of apologetics came into it. And it just struck me that, my goodness, nobody seems to know right from wrong anymore. And perhaps we're in some kind of a moral crisis. As I watched the media come in more and more, I started looking at it through a media lens, you know, as a career journalist and a media strategist. It just became, you know, so clear what was happening. All the tricks of the trade were being used. And this is not coverage of an event. This is an orchestrated campaign. It's very well organized. It's very well thought out. It is extremely skillful. And I just wanted to make people aware of that. So I launched Moral Clarity. And when I launched it, I was a little bit concerned that maybe there's not an appetite for long form journalism anymore. Maybe, you know, I should be doing something on TikTok, but I didn't do that because, you know, it's, you reach people when you do it that way, but you also dumb it down when you do it that way. But much to my surprise, you know, it's had a huge response and now have readers in 45 countries. And just, you know, consistently I get emails from people saying things like, I'm a Roman Catholic and I care about the truth. So it's not just a Jewish audience that has latched on to this. And I think that's because, A, I'm writing a little more widely than Israel, although I'm writing extensively on it. But the response to Israel really is the perfect case study of what is going on in our society and our culture more widely. So that was the origins of it. And it's just kind of gone from strength to strength.
So you weren't writing in this kind of a vein before October the 7th. This really brought you out of your shell, so to speak.
Yeah, that's correct. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've mainly been a financial journalist, an economics journalist, writing about all those kinds of things. Obviously, economics and finance connect very directly with politics. You cannot write about finance and economics without looking at politics. They're not things that can be separated. It's just I've taken my lens that was on the financial and moved it to the political.
Well, your efforts are certainly most welcome, Nahum, I would say. Given your experience in some of the world's leading newsrooms, what can you say about attitudes that you've come across concerning Israel in your own experience?
In my own experience, it's very much been a case of they know what the Israel story is before any particular event happens. So there is a whole lot of premises around the Israel-Palestinian conflict. And a good example would be the West Bank is occupied. Now, there's certainly a political consensus that the West Bank is occupied. That's certainly the case. But then they go on, it's illegally occupied. And that's an entirely different question and a much more complicated question because it's not entirely clear at all that it is illegally occupied. But the whole discussion around that does not exist. It is an article of faith that the West Bank is occupied. And every story is written from that premise, and that's already set up partisan coverage, because as soon as you've said that, you've got one side in the wrong. Now, once you've got one side in the wrong from the start, you no longer have objective journalism anymore, because you're working on a premise that one side is the aggressor or one side is the wrong party. And there are other examples of it. The idea that Gaza is an open-air prison, would be another one. None of these people have stepped foot in Gaza, yet are making pronouncements of what life is like there. And it's just an article of faith that is going on. There is an article of faith that the Palestinians are fighting for a state. And no doubt some of them are. But groups like Hamas are not fighting for a state. They are an Islamist caliphate-seeking organization, and they make no bones about it. And even that just gets pushed down. The reporting starts from the premise that Israel's running a prison in Gaza. Israel's occupied the West Bank, and it's fighting an opponent that wants a state that it will not let it have. All of those things are incorrect. And from a journalistic point of view, it should be reported and pointed out. It's a pretty deep fundamental problem because in newsrooms, no one is asking the questions or making the point that I have just made, or very, very few anyhow.
Well, this has really been a perennial problem. It's not suddenly emerged following October 7th, but it's been concentrated now and emphasised.
Yes, I think that's right. You're absolutely right. It is a perennial problem. What's happened, I think, is October 7 has brought it into sharp relief, and it's also revealed the scale of it. I think the scale of it is much worse than certainly I realised.
Hmm. So this is your reaction to the media in general about the ongoing war in Gaza, those particular points you've just mentioned. We'll go into this in a bit more detail by referring to what you've written. Being Australian, do you take any special interest in the way the Australian media is operating in this Israel-Gaza war?
The Australian media has, by and large, fallen for all the same tropes and problems that media elsewhere has. I mean, particular media. I mean, SBS in Australia, for example, is actually using coverage from Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is a mouthpiece of the Qatari government. It is set up for that purpose. Al Jazeera reporters in Gaza have been active Hamas fighters and terrorists. This has been documented. When Israel shoots those terrorists, it gets reported as Israel is targeting journalists. It is just kind of surreal. But on the ABC in particular, on SBS in particular, we have seen a lot of this. The Guardian, of course, in Australia, the Australian version I'm talking about, not the UK version, although their Middle East coverage is substantially similar. I guess the only real pushback in Australia has been from Sky.
Yeah, from Sky and the Australian newspaper.
And the Australian, yeah, good point. Yeah. Yeah.
But they're all under the same umbrella of news media. That's where that all stems from.
Yeah, correct.
Your article that you wrote, I think we're going back now to just a few days ago, this one, Stopping the News Media Rot. This pertains to what we're talking about. So what have you said there that can elaborate on what we've been talking about?
As I alluded to earlier, the coverage of the Israel-Palestinian conflict really is a microcosm of what's happening more broadly in our media. And I think media standards have started to decline in the last 20 years or so. there are lots of great journalists out there still. There is no doubt about that. And there is lots of great pieces of journalism being done. There's no doubt about that either. But I'm not so sure there are any great institutions of journalism left. You know, the days when you say, oh, the New York Times is one of the great journalistic institutions of the world. I don't think there's any paper that we can say that about credibly anymore without somebody laughing at us or rolling their eyes. It's hard to pinpoint exactly where that happened, but I think it's really useful to have a bigger sweep of it all and look at it pre-internet, post-internet. The internet brought all sorts of confluences onto newsrooms. But the first thing it did was disrupt their business model. Now, it disrupted their business models because business model was essentially, we sell newspapers at a nominal price to get a mass subscription. And then we take that mass audience, present it to advertisers to advertise against. And that's where the real money is made. And that had served the industry for the better part of 100 years very, very well. Then the internet comes along and advertisers realize, you know, we can advertise to our audience directly via the internet. We don't need to go through an intermediary like the media to do that anymore. So it just becomes more effective because you can target your audience, and it becomes more economic because there's not a middleman, i.e. the newspaper, taking a cut. Newspapers take an economic hit, and their response to that is to shrink their newsrooms. And they're shrinking the newsroom because they just don't have the funds to sustain a large newsroom anymore. So it's kind of the first hit to media quality. And the technology did something different as well. It disintermediated the flow of information. Now, I can remember as a young reporter going down to the finance ministry, and you would wait for the government to announce the inflation numbers. The government would announce the inflation numbers, and the journalists would scramble to write that first. And it would be the journalists who are distributing that information. What happens now is the finance ministry will just post that number onto its website. So the journalist role is redundant in that flow of information. Once this happened, newspapers started to think, oh, wow, you know, we don't have a role to play here anymore. The response to that was a fewfold. But the main response was that we have to change what we write so that people will be willing to pay for it, because getting people to pay is essential because we don't have advertising revenue anymore. And we have to write something that people cannot get themselves from something like the government just releasing information on the website. So the answer to this was what newsrooms call move up the value chain, which is, you know, it's McKinsey kind of speak, isn't it? This kind of idea that it's not enough to report news anymore. You have to tell people why it's important and what's going to happen next. Now, this is the point where news started to move more and more into being analysis and fortune telling. You know, this is what's going to happen next. This is going to be a disaster. And it turns out that journalists aren't very good analysts because they're just different skill sets, right? And nobody's good at predicting the future. Like Yogi Berra said, right? I try to avoid predictions, especially about the future. So newspapers were pushed into that. And the part of newspapers that once were clearly marked, opinion and editorial, and that would be a small part of the newspaper in the middle, this kind of writing now occupies all of a newspaper. Automatically, newspapers are not news. They're now kind of analysis. Now, because they need people to buy this to make their money without advertising, they have to write what people want. And this phenomena in media circles is known as audience capture. So you get captured by your audience. You write, for example, a right-wing view of the world. You attract right-wing readers and subscribers and viewers. And then you have to present that because that's where you're making your money now. And if you don't present that, then, you know, you risk upsetting them and losing them. And this is just a race to the extreme in terms of media coverage. So there has always been, you know, right-leaning and left-leaning media. But now the left is over here and the right is over here. They're at extremes now. And that, to some extent, represents the broader political divide in Western cultures at the moment. But it's not just a reflection of it. It's a contributor to it. It's really dangerous in a democracy where we don't have an agreed set of facts or an agreed narrative. Now, we can disagree on the margins of the narrative, or we can disagree precisely how the dots should be connected together. But that's not what we have at the moment. What we have is newspapers that are living in parallel universes.
There's also great competition from commentators like yourself, who operate independently of the main news media, and they're providing commentary, which in many cases is superior to what newspapers are providing.
Yeah, that's a good point. So people like myself and have really moved in to fill what they perceive are the gaps left in the media by this polarization. So people are looking at it and they're saying, well, let's provide a perspective that actually is not a crazy perspective. Once would have been a fairly mainstream perspective, but now because everything's become polarized, that view is not being heard at all. So people have started moving into that. And because people like myself writing these things don't have any audience capture, we can write what we want and how we honestly see it without sort of having some commercial boat that we have to upend.
Yes, well, I'm kind of in the same game too, in a sense, Nahum.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes. So I came across your initiative, Moral Clarity, Truths in Politics and Culture, by way of an essay you wrote that was published on Joshua Hoffman's site, Future of Jewish. And a few weeks ago, I interviewed Joshua and have been following his posts. I'm referring to the piece titled The Stunning Dystopian Strategy Behind Hamas's Media Machine. Hamas has had great success controlling the West's narratives about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, despite most of it being outright lies, as you have said in your piece. How have they achieved this? Do you want to go through the reasons that they are succeeding in what they're doing?
Yeah, certainly. It's really interesting to watch, because I think one of the things that doesn't get talked about enough when we talk about Hamas is how capable and intelligent these people are, that they are in the thrall to some terrible ideas. But you think of this underground network of tunnels, for example, that they had built in Gaza. If that energy had been driven or put into building a state, one can only imagine how good life in Gaza might have been. And that same kind of skill has been, and intelligence has been brought into their media approach. So they've recognized, you know, lots of things really. One of the great things they've done is actually, when I say great, I mean great from a PR point of view. I don't mean great from a moral point of view. One of the effective things they've done is they've co-opted other people to be their spokespeople. They have co-opted the United Nations and many of its officials to talk for it. They have got media around the world acting as its mouthpiece. They have got politicians and even world leaders in parliaments around the world talking for it. And obviously these voices have greater credibility than Hamas talking about it themselves. It's a really interesting question as to how did they do this? How did they do it? And they did it with some old-fashioned sociological analysis. The first thing they identified was that anti-Semitism in the West is only ever dormant. It's never asleep. So they didn't have to build a whole new narrative. All they had to do was wake the sleeping monster, and then they would have a natural ally. And the primary way they did this was basically taking old anti-Semitic blood libel tropes in particular and updating them. So the old blood libel tropes become Israel is committing genocide, Israel is engaged in ethnic cleansing, you know, Israel is murdering babies as part of that. And most recent version of the updated blood libel is that they are starving Gazans.
Yes.
But, you know, all this is just, they've just updated the blood libel. And because anti-Semitism was there, just dormant, all they needed to do was wake it. And they did that very, very successfully. And then they had a natural ally with people with whom they agree on absolutely nothing else. Then the next thing they did was recognize that they had a numerical advantage in two ways. Now, it is too simplistic to say that, you know, all Muslims support the Palestinian side and all Jews support, or Jews and evangelical Christians or whatever support the Israel side. There's more nuance to it than that. Nevertheless, it is largely true. Now, there's over 1 billion Muslims in the world, and there are 16 million Jews in the world, or whatever that the number happens to be. Now, in the world of social media, where basically that is a virtual army waiting to be activated, it's going to be almost impossible for the Jewish narrative or the Israeli narrative to stand up to that. It just overwhelming array of numbers. And they knew this. And they kind of exploited two particular biases that is often used in media. They exploited what's called the repetition bias and the immediacy bias. I don't know if I mentioned the immediacy bias in my piece, actually. So the repetition bias is just a psychological shortcut in which when we see something over and over again, we think it is more likely to be true than something that we've only just heard or something we've not heard very many times. They know, but just by repeating and repeating and repeating and repeating and repeating, doesn't matter if it's true, doesn't matter if it's not, our brains are almost wired to see this as oh yeah, this is true. I'm reading it everywhere. It's got to be true. And the second one is the immediacy bias, in which we think things that happen now are much more important than things that happened in the past. On October 7th, that was the most important thing in the world. Now, as soon as Hamas had been successful in shifting the narrative to look at the terrible things being done to Palestinians in Israel's response, because that is happening now and October 7th happened in the past, that feels like it's the most important part of the story when it's not necessarily the case. So they've exploited these two biases very systematically and very cleverly.
Actually, before you go on with the next point, as far as this numerical advantage is concerned, Nachum, they actually claim the high moral ground because they say they have the numbers. If there's more numbers supporting their side, well, their side must be right.
Yes, indeed. It's an absurd piece of reasoning, of course, and the Earth would still be round if 90% of humans thought it was flat. It would still be round. So there isn't a voting floor or a democracy on facts or truth. But you know, nevertheless, you know, we are group species. We like to fit into those around us. This kind of argument does resonate with people, even though in their more rational moment they know that it's not. The other sort of numerical advantage they exploited was just the number of Muslim states that there are. And this is really a key one. Because there are 40-odd Muslim states in the world, this has enabled them to get power in all sorts of multilateral institutions, from the United Nations itself to, you know, World Health Organization, to any number of multilateral institutions that you can think of. And what this does is it gives them credible people, or people with credible titles more accurately, because some of them are not actually credible at all. But there is a real credibility when someone turns up and says, you know, I'm the head of, you know, let me make one up. I'm the head of the World Food Aid Program at the United Nations, and I say there's starvation in Gaza. Now, the fact that someone with such a title, with such an institution behind them is saying that gives it real kind of authority. And because there are so many Muslim states and they have managed to get credible heads in so many positions, it really does sound like there is universal condemnation of it. But it's not. It's just a political body that they've managed to hijack.
So you've commented further in your article about controlling the information flow as being another strategy.
Yes, controlling the information flow is, of course, is a key one. And they've done this in a couple of ways. They've done this both in Gaza and both in the West Bank. But in the case of Gaza, Israel's contributed this to some degree, to be honest, because the IDF has not allowed foreign media full access to Gaza. Now, Hamas has recognized this, which means they've basically produced an army of stringer journalists, if you like, and photographers who are feeding news that cannot be verified from Gaza, sending photographs that cannot be verified from Gaza. So they've got a complete monopoly on the information coming out of Gaza because nobody else can get in. So they've exploited that very, very cleverly. On the West Bank part, they've just used more traditional authoritarian tactics. It has been the case for a long time that if you want to have access to the Palestinian territories and access to report from there, you cannot be too critical of the Palestinian Authority or you will be thrown out, you will be targeted, your family will be targeted. And there are many Palestinian journalists who have tried to write about the corruption of the Palestinian Authority who have been subject to this. You know, for international correspondents, if they do not have access, they cannot justify being there, spending their nights at nice hotels in Tel Aviv, they have to toe the line as well. They've managed to control it through force and through restriction of access and threats of losing restriction of access. They've got large amount of control of the information flow coming out of those regions.
So I recommend this particular article, and I'll share it with my listeners so they can go into it in greater depth than we have time to do right now. In the same vein, Nachum, you've written a couple more articles recently, namely The Great Moral Inversion and War of the Words, Israel, Hamas and Truth, which appeared late last year. So clearly this issue of media manipulation is of major concern to you. Is there a way out of this situation where Israel faces the brunt of mass media that is largely critical and often antagonistic toward Israel?
Oh, I wish I could answer that question definitively, but I'm most certainly not equipped to do so.
Positively, at least.
Positively, at least. There's certainly, and you know, this is a piece that I'm currently working on. Israel can play a much better PR hand than they have done so far. There's no doubt about it. Hamas have played the perfect PR hand. Israel has had a hand-fisted go at it. And there's a whole variety of reasons for that, you know, to do with the nature of Israel being a democracy and having a free press, to do with the fact that it's a divided society, to do with the fact that its cabinet is a mismatch of people from across the political spectrum, who has, you know, quite extremist people talking, and then what they're talking about gets perceived overseas as government policy when it's not. So there's all sorts of things that they could do differently to find a better PR game. Is that enough to overcome the numerical and the structural disadvantages that they face? I don't think so. I think the best thing Israel can do is fight a better PR war, but actually win the actual war. Win it quickly, win it decisively. Then the PR war doesn't matter so much because there isn't anything going on to tell lies about.
Well, I've really enjoyed speaking with you, Nachum. We're very much on the same page. And I think my listeners will certainly appreciate what you're doing, and I recommend them to go to your site to catch what you're writing. How would they do that?
So it's a Substack site. It's called Moral Clarity, Truth in Politics and Culture. So if you just go to Substack and type that in, it will come up. Some of the stuff is behind a paywall, but the majority of it is freely available. All the new stuff is definitely freely available. It's mainly archival stuff that's behind the paywall. But if you do want to pay for it to support, no, I won't say no.
Well, I thank you again, Nahum. Great job you're doing, and we appreciate it, I must say.
Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate that too.
You've just been listening to an interview with a former Aussie, Nachum Kaplan, who has created the site Moral Clarity, Truths in Politics and Culture, in order to redress the lies and misinformation being disseminated every day. Complete versions of this interview and my earlier one with the director of the film about the Nova Music Festival massacre will be made available as separate podcasts. Until next week, it's goodbye from the Israel Connection.